Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It with Allison Stewart on WNYC. Eboo Patel is one of the leading interfaith activists in the country. He's the founder and president of the Interfaith Youth Corps, which promotes interfaith cooperation on college campuses. He served on President Barack Obama's inaugural advisory council on faith-based neighborhood partnerships, and he's the author of a new book, Out of Many Faiths, Religious Diversity and the American Promise, which is out now from Princeton University Press, and its publication of Out of Many Faiths has brought Eboo Patel to our show today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Allison.
Your book is called Out of Many Faiths and is a staunch defense of the centrality of religious diversity to the American identity and the American experience. Yet, the acceptance of religious diversity is difficult for many people. Why is that?
Well, one of the reasons religious diversity is challenging is because the expression of one tradition can sometimes be a violation of another tradition. So, for example, Muslims like me, we not only eat meat regularly, but ritually on a holiday like Eid. It's actually part of the religious ceremony in some ways. And people from other religions, Jains, Buddhists, and Hindus, view that as taking God-given life. And those are deep and really challenging differences that we ought to respect. I think that the fact that religious diversity is so difficult ought to lead us to recognize just how remarkable the United States' story is on this, that we have managed to create a pretty healthy, religiously diverse democracy. There have been some ugly moments, sometimes when the forces of prejudice have been strong, but the forces of pluralism have always overcome them. I think that we're living at a time when the forces of prejudice are strong again, and I think that this is a time for an interfaith cooperation or pluralism movement to meet those forces and to help write the next chapter in the great story of American interfaith cooperation.
You've called the hyphen in Muslim American, you call it a bridge, not a separation. What do you mean?
I mean, what makes you a better Muslim, somebody who embraces compassion and mercy and tolerance and diversity, makes you a better American. Those are values that are deeply embedded in the American tradition and in the Muslim tradition. There's actually a really powerful Muslim symbol of Medina. Medina is the city that the Prophet Muhammad, may the peace and blessings of God be upon him, moved to in the year 622 when he was hounded and harassed out of his home city of Mecca. And Medina welcomed the Prophet Muhammad and his companions. And actually, the welcomers were viewed as holy, the Ansar, and the immigrants were viewed as holy, the Muhajirun. And I think of that as part of the American story also, this notion that people who come here, that kind of immigration narrative is a sacred story. And when we welcome those people and encourage them to enrich this society, that is a holy act as well. So I think, you know, just like other religious communities have contributed their sacred symbols, city on a hill, beloved community, cathedral of humanity, almost chosen people, those are all symbols that are kind of part of the broader American civil narrative that were taken from religious communities or adopted from religious communities. Now that Muslims have appreciable numbers in America, it's time for us to be able to contribute those symbols and to the narrative as well.
We're speaking with Eboo Patel. His new book is called Out of Many Faiths, Religious Diversity and the American Promise. So Eboo, I wonder how you feel about the assimilation versus acceptance idea, the melting pot versus the bouillabaisse as an analogy for America, a melting pot where everybody's identity comes together and you're one as an American versus the bouillabaisse where you have all the different ingredients making a big, beautiful stew.
Right. Well, I'm definitely with the second and actually use a similar metaphor in my book. I say we're not a melting pot, we're a potluck dinner. And a potluck only happens when diverse people, in this case, diverse communities in the United States, bring dishes that they specialize in. It's not a very good potluck if everybody brings, you know, the same dish, right? You want people to be contributing the best from their heritage. And you also want there to be kind of a set of loose guidelines around this potluck. If there are people at the potluck who have peanut allergies, you want people to be aware of that. And really cool things happen at potlucks. Fusions emerge. People try new things. People put together new combinations. And that's how I see America. I see American strength resulting largely from our ability to welcome the contributions of a wide variety of communities. And that's one of the reasons I think that any kind of prejudice, including religious prejudice, is so harmful. It not only violates the dignity of the community at stake, but it also is a barrier to their contribution. Why would we want to erect barriers to the contribution of anybody who wants to make our society better?
I want to get your take on something. Cordoba House last summer, there was a push to create a design for an Islamic cultural center. We had the first Muslim-sponsored multi-faith community center in New York City. And there's a line from the proposal for this 100,000-square-foot facility. And here's the quote. There are approximately 800,000 Muslims living in New York City. A majority of the gathering places for Muslims are mosques that focus on religion as practice, which does not leave enough room for developing religion as a culture. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think religion is many things, right? Religion is ritual practice. It's worship. It's belief. It's doctrine. It's also institutions that serve the common good. And actually, that's a huge part of America's success story. Back when Alexis de Tocqueville was doing his tour of America in the early 19th century, he points out that religion is the first of America's political institutions. It's hugely involved in what he called the mother science of America, which is, as he put it, the art of association, which was this quality of Americans to kind of gather together and create civic communities and civic institutions. So religious communities are at the center of that. Robert Putnam from Harvard University in his 1990s era book called Bowling Alone says that roughly half of America's social capital is contributed or inspired by religious communities. So Fordham University there in New York, the wide variety of Catholic K through 12 schools, the Catholic and hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. The Presbyterian Hospital, right? I'm a Chicagoan, so I'm kind of trying to remember my New York geography a little bit here. But there is a huge amount of social capital and civic institutions that religious communities contribute. And a huge part of what makes America strong is the ability to welcome those contributions.
You founded the Interfaith Youth Corps in the aftermath of 9/11. It was a real moment of crisis for our country and for Muslims who live in America who are American. Are we at a similar moment of crisis now?
I think so. One of the things about the crisis of 9/11 was there was this huge question amongst the American population, which is, you know, what is this Islam thing and who are Muslims, right? And if the only thing you know about New York or about Chicago is the first minute of the local evening news, then you look at that entire city through the lens of its criminals. And so if the only thing you know about Islam is 9/11, well, then you're looking at a 1,400-year-old religion with 1.6 billion adherents only as something that commits and creates terrorism, which is obviously dramatically warped. But one of the things about 9/11 was that people in positions of leadership, while I disagree with their policy moves, particularly around the Iraq War, they were clear that American Muslims were part of the American family, contributed, ought to be welcomed, ought to be respected, certainly shouldn't be harmed. And that is not the message that's coming from official sources today. And I think that this is a moment that ought to remind us of anti-Catholicism in the mid-19th century, when the anti-Catholic Know Nothing Party literally had 75 seats in the United States Congress. We ought to be meeting this moment of prejudice with the forces of pluralism and writing the next chapter in the great American story of interfaith cooperation.
The name of the book is Out of Many Faiths, Religious Diversity and the American Promise. Eboo Patel, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
Later in the show, we keep discussing faith. This time, it's Christianity and rock music. Perhaps a once unlikely pair, the genre of Christian rock has endured. We'll learn its origin story and why it's such a popular form of music. Stay with All of It. We'll be right back after a quick break. Yeah. You're listening to All of It with Allison Stewart. Khalaf Hassani became a staff writer at The New Yorker in 2008. He's written about boxing, comedy, politics, high-end coffee, but he has always returned to music journalism. It's his sweet spot. And for the September 24th issue of The New Yorker, he's taken on Christian rock, a musical genre that started in the 1960s, but whose legacy has influenced some of the biggest musicians to this day. The name of the piece is The Unlikely Endurance of Christian Rock. Kelly Fasani, welcome to All of It. Kay, you start your piece with this story of Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. writing a advice column for Ebony. That in itself is an interesting story about rock and roll. What was his position on rock and roll and religion?
Well, you know, it's not as if this was a major plank of what he was doing, but someone wrote in and said, you know, I love rock and roll, I love gospel, I don't know, what should I do? And Martin Luther King was strict in response. He was like, whatever you do, don't combine them. Because gospel, you know, orients people toward the higher things, and rock and roll puts your mind straight into the gutter, and you've got to keep these things separate. Now, again, this wasn't, it's not as if he was going around barnstorming the country giving speeches about rock and roll, but this reflects what I think was a fairly common view among many people at the time, especially many religious people, which was that rock and roll was not good news, and that it shouldn't be mixed with the good news, and that you really want to keep these things separate. And what he would have known is what a lot of people would have known, was that these two things were also kind of connected, right? A lot of the early rock stars, from Sister Rosetta Tharpe to Jerry Lee Lewis, come out of the church, specifically the Pentecostal church.
Well, there's a lot of hooping and hollering.
Exactly. And so then you're seeing people hooping and hollering on stage, and you know, Little Richard, and next thing you know, the Beatles are hooping and hollering. And so there was this idea that these things were mixing in a way that could be kind of combustible or could be kind of maybe even inappropriate if you're someone that wants to keep preachers preaching and not get it mixed up with the kind of entertainment that's the soundtrack for whatever the kids are doing on the weekends.
So how did Christian rock create its own lane?
Well, so it's funny, you have this tradition of rock and gospel music, and Christian rock really comes out of a slightly different thing, which is it comes out of the hippie movement. It comes out of the fact that by the late 60s, you have this rock and roll movement that is in a way religious, although not Christian, which is to say you have all these hippies and these spiritual seekers and they're exploring Eastern religions. And so a handful of pastors get to thinking that this might be a place where they can do some evangelism. This might be a place where they can go and spread the word. And in an odd way, part of the argument they're making for Christianity is Christianity is weird too. In other words, you're into all these weird spiritual traditions. Why don't you come check out this thing, which is actually pretty radical in its own way? You can read this book, the Bible, which has a radical message of love that's not that different from what you guys are into. So you see in the Bay Area, you start to see it around Los Angeles, what comes to be known as the Jesus Movement. And this is a bunch of pastors ministering to these folks, sometimes bringing these folks into their congregations, into their churches, sometimes establishing eventually group houses for Christians to live. And one of the people that is associated with this movement is a guy named Larry Norman. He was a rock guy. He was in a band called People. He had actually come to Christ, I think, when he was 5, he once said. And he said he did it of his own accord, which makes sense because he seemed to do absolutely everything he did of his own accord. And so he was not evangelized by one of these pastors, but he was kind of a weird hippie guy who made a record called Upon This Rock in 1969, which was one of the first, certainly not one of the first records that's a rock record made by a Christian, but one of the first intentionally Christian records where that seems to be the message. And over the next couple years, what happens is the Jesus Movement and the people in it, known as Jesus People or sometimes Jesus Freaks was another term that was used, they get really popular. In other words, it kind of becomes a national obsession. In 1972 in Dallas, there's this gathering called Expo 72, which is supposed to be sort of the Christian Woodstock. One of the headliners is Larry Norman. Another of the headliners is Billy Graham, who's like the most popular mainstream pastor in the country. There's some reporting that Richard Nixon wanted to make an appearance, and the organizers had to think about it and eventually said, no, we don't want Richard Nixon, and had to find a way to sort of uninvite him. But you have this huge gathering in Dallas that represents basically the Jesus Movement having a real moment. And like I said, there's tons of national press. And so because of that, Larry Norman, whose albums didn't sell super well, became one of the faces of this thing, this Jesus movement. And he looked the part. He had sort of
He looks like one of the Allman Brothers.
Yeah, he has long, blondish hair. And he has this, and his albums have this incredible combination of sort of severity and kind of wistful playfulness. And you know, it's a combination where you can look at it musically, and it made sense with a lot of other stuff that was happening. You know, his singing voice was sort of high and a little shaky and not totally unlike Neil Young or something. But it also had this really mystical feeling that was related to his religious faith. And so that kind of became a really his music became something that was really inspiring to a generation of musicians, a generation of young Christians. In time, he actually became sort of a cult figure. The first Pixies record, "Come On Pilgrim," is named after a Larry Norman lyric. So he attracts this interesting and far-flung fan base. But that first record, "Upon This Rock," 1969, is often considered basically the birth of Christian rock as a genre.
Let's take a listen to a little Larry Norman so people can get a sense of what he was about.
Gonorrhea on Valentine's Day, BD, and you're still looking for the perfect thing. You think rock and roll will set you free, honey? You'd be dead before you're 33. Shooting junk till you're half insane.
That could be like any Skynyrd, or it really has that vibe. And he tackles the two issues, sex and drugs.
Yeah, and a lot of his songs actually aren't even that explicit in terms of you need to come to Jesus. His best known song is probably "I Wish We'd All Been Ready," which is a song about the rapture. And it's this kind of spooky ballad about what's going to happen when some people, you know, the Christians, the believers, all disappear, and everyone else is left stumbling around the earth. And the kind of refrain is, "I wish we'd all been ready. I wish everyone had gotten this message so they could have all been included." And, you know, again, he finds a way to make songs where it's not every song is not, "Oh, you need to come to Jesus." And in fact, later in his career, he helps inspire this genre of Christian rock. But as the genre builds and grows, he ends up being a little bit of an outcast. And part of that is because he's kind of an annoying person, as far as we can tell. Greg Thornbury has this biography of Larry Norman published earlier this year, and that's partly what my piece was about. And the biography really tries to make a case for Larry Norman and put him in the best light possible. And even reading through that lens, you can tell that, I guess like a lot of rock stars, he's kind of a difficult person, and he tries to run a record label, and that kind of doesn't work out, and he has feuds with all these people, and he's in exile, and he's not talking to this person, and so he ends up kind of in his own world, putting out albums that are kind of strange. In the Christian rock genre, all these conventions emerge, right? And you're kind of supposed to not drink, not smoke, a lot of lyrics about Jesus. And he sort of resents some of that. And he figures, look, I'm a Christian and I make rock music, so all my music is Christian rock, no matter what the lyrics are about. But in his wake, a whole ecosystem springs up. And you have a whole series of bands making records, playing shows, sometimes in churches. Calvary Church in California becomes an important hub of this world. You get in the 1970s, you get a bunch of Christian rock radio stations, and you know some of what they're playing is like a little more easy listening. B.J. Thomas, the country Christian pop crooner, a singer named Evie is a pretty big deal, and then going into the 1980s, Christian rock as rock music.
That's when it gets interesting.
Well, it's where you get music. And again, a lot of the stuff that's happening in the 70s is great. There's this guy, Phil Kagi, who's an incredible guitar player who's made a whole bunch of great records. In the 80s, you get, I guess, what would be considered hard rock. You get
and kind of more commercial.
Yeah. You get bands figuring out they can really sell. You get Petra. You get Stryper, which is, I believe, the first Christian rock album to have that's a real kind of blockbuster hit. Again, some of this stuff, you know, the big Stryper hit is called "Honestly," which kind of just sounds like a power ballad. But at some of their concerts, at some point, the members of Stryper throw, you know, pocket Bibles into the audience. You know, they're making records like To Hell with the Devil. So there is a certain drive to be explicit about what you're doing, to make music that's explicitly Christian.
We're speaking with Kelleh Fasane, who goes by Kay. His latest piece with The New Yorker is The Unlikely Endurance of Christian Rock. Stryper, you brought up. I think they were the first Christian rock band to go platinum. They played arenas, and they had that look, the big hair, the teased up hair, the spandex.
Yeah, they're dressed in all black and yellow like bumblebees.
Exactly. Let's play a very little bit of Stryper because I don't want to scare the afternoon public radio audience off. Very little. Is the objective to sell records here, or was the objective to spread the word of God?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, you want obviously these bands want to sell records. Obviously, they want to reach people. I think there's a third thing that sometimes gets forgotten. People think about Christian rock as, oh, the idea is to find unsuspecting listeners and convert them. And, you know, most of the time that's not that realistic. And most of the time that's not necessarily the objective. I think just as important for many of these bands was to sing songs for Christians. I mean, if you think about the great Christian hymns, they're not designed to be sung in public so that non-believers will hear them and run to church. They're songs to be sung to Christians and by Christians in church. They're music to encourage Christians, to encourage reflection among Christians. So, you know, again, it's not just the case that for it to be important, it has to reach people outside of this world, because it's really important to make music for people inside the world, too. I think one of the debates that was roiling this world was, what is this music supposed to sound like? Is it supposed to be happy? Is it supposed to be pleasant? And one of the things that happens in the 80s is this idea emerges that it's really about the lyrics, and that as long as your lyrics are on point, as long as your lyrics are in accordance with your beliefs, the sound can be kind of whatever you want. And, you know, sometimes that means you end up with songs that are hitting you over the head with a message. But what it also meant was that bands could explore all sorts of other genres, right? You have a punk scene, a Christian punk scene that arises in L.A. You get a handful of really good Christian thrash metal records by Mortification, by Vengeance Rising. Talk about scaring public radio listeners. I mean, you get stuff that sounds really harsh. There's a great Christian death metal band from Norway called Extol that put out a series of great records. So one of the things that happens because of this ethos is you get bands really pushing the limit. If Christian music can sound like anything, well, why can't we be screaming at the top of our lungs if we want?
So for every genre, there seems to emerge a Christian lane. Is that what it is?
That's often the case. And again, it makes a certain sort of sense. It goes back to the idea that Larry Norman had, which is that if you're Christian, you should be able to express that through whatever kind of music you want. And that's something that people have kind of wrestled with in this genre, because, you know, there is music that's played in church. And if a song is going to be played in church, it's probably not going to be people screaming at the top of their lungs. And whatever era we're in, there's probably going to be some kind of music that freaks people out, right? And that makes people think, oh, even if I do believe in that music can sound like whatever, I don't really understand this death metal record, and maybe it freaks me out that my kid is listening to it. But by the 90s and certainly in the aughts, you had a really big, really thriving Christian punk and hardcore scene. And you had, you know, you had kids slam dancing, you had the whole thing. You had Christian bands going out on Warped Tour. So this really did lead to genres that would have seemed kind of hard to imagine back in the 1960s when this started out.
I want to play for people one that I found fascinating because it's almost note for note Nirvana's Smell Like Teen Spirit. It's from a band called DC Talk, and the song is called Jesus Freak. Take a listen to this.
Born of a concept, but all men are free and equal.
Separated, I cut myself clean from a past that comes back in my darkest of dreams. Been that brand new.
That's sort of Pearl Sound Guard Nirvana sounding chains, Allison.
Yeah, and DC Talk was actually a really important band in this world. They kind of started out a little more hip-hop. There's three members. One was African-American, two were white, which was also unusual in this world where a lot of the bands were white. And, you know, they're still going, especially Toby Mac, the lead singer, still making records, still a big force in the world of Christian rock.
Now, there's also this other next evolution of Christians who are in rock bands.
Right.
Obviously, U2 is the one we think about, but Paramore. I think that the band Paramore, the lead singer. But she has said, you know, I don't necessarily want to be associated as a Christian rock band because that might hurt my viability as a pop band.
Well, yeah, or there's just a sense that both commercially and artistically, there was this sense that some people believe, not all people, but some musicians started to feel like Christian rock was a ghetto. And if you're in a band, 21 Pilots is a good example. If you're in a band, even if you have roots in Christianity or even in Christian rock, you don't want your band to be categorized that way. And one of the things that happened, you know, starting about 15, 20 years ago, was a whole bunch of bands that were able to get play on mainstream secular rock radio despite having some sort of connection to Christianity or Christian rock, you know, whether that's, you know, Chevelle or Creed or Switchfoot, or I mean, there's a whole bunch of them, Skillet, a whole bunch of bands that are able to kind of straddle these worlds. And again, this raises this question of how explicit about faith should this music be? In other words, are these bands selling out if they're making songs and they're not mentioning Jesus? Or is it the other way around? Or is it the bands that are selling out are the ones that are talking a lot about faith so that they can get sold in Christian bookstores, which were a very important retail space back in the day, and so they can play these big Christian festivals? So it really is an ongoing debate in this world about how stealthy these bands should be, how explicit they should be about what they're doing. And, you know, obviously in the end it comes down to a personal choice, and there's bands now that are still pretty big and in the Christian rock world, and then there's bands that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily even think of as Christian rock bands.
And bands that have strong faith, like is the Imagine Dragons?
Imagine Dragons, the lead singer is Mormon. And it's funny, in the when this stuff first started happening and Larry Norman is going on tour, he got a review where someone said, you know, you may believe, as we all do, that Christianity is dying, but you should still check out this genre. And, you know, all these years later, if Christian rock has a problem, it's not so much that Christianity is dying, it's that rock doesn't always seem like the most exciting genre, you know? So something like Christian hip-hop, if you're a pastor, and there's tons of Christian hip-hop, and Christian hip-hop might seem like a more effective way to reach young people. I should also say that this music was always, like a lot about our music and like a lot about our faith traditions, there was an aspect of segregation, which is that traditionally, African-American performers making popular music that was influenced by their religious faith, a lot of times that was classed as gospel, even if it sounded like R&B, sometimes even if it sounded sort of like hip-hop. And so for much of its history, a lot of the Christian rock scene has been kind of de facto a white scene, and it's been a way of denoting what white Christian musicians are doing. And so that's something that maybe is changing a little bit now. But that was also part of the definition of what Christian rock was.
That's what I was thinking. Kirk Franklin is one of the biggest artists out there, but you would never put him in this group.
No, I mean, he's gospel, and the gospel world is a whole separate world that he and a lot of people exist in.
But
and
he like plays stadiums.
Yeah,
you know?
and there's a thriving gospel. Well, it's two things. One, there's a thriving gospel community that these artists in the gospel world can play in. The other is that one of the things that made Christian rock so distinctive is that there was this conventional wisdom that Christianity was somehow, and rock and roll were somehow hostile to each other. And in African-American genres, that didn't exist in the same way. There wasn't a presumption that a rapper or an R&B singer would somehow not be Christian. And, you know, when Beyonce sings, you know, I'm not going to compromise my Christianity in that Destiny's Child song, you know, no one is taken aback by that. That's just considered kind of normal. So there was this perception that there would be a kind of a hostility built into rock and roll that wouldn't exist in some other genres, especially in African-American genres. And I think that's related to why Christian rock had a bad reputation for a lot of years. There was this idea that Christian rock is not cool, or that it's lame, or that because these people are Christian, they can't be real rockers. They're playing it safe. And so, you know, that's something that I think is largely in the past. But that also has to do with the twin mythologies that were built up around rock and roll and around Christianity.
What do you think is the next evolution of Christian rock?
That's a good question. Again, those things are so mixed right now that it doesn't really raise eyebrows, right? And there's plenty of bands where fans, you know, if you're a Mumford & Sons fan, maybe you know that Marcus Mumford's parents are religious, and maybe you know that he's kind of talked about faith in certain ways, but you might not mind that much how he's classified. So, you know, I think we're at a moment where a lot of that stuff is kind of mixed all together.
Kelafasane, thanks for joining us. Kay's piece is in the September 24th issue of The New Yorker magazine. It's called The Unlikely Endurance of Christian Rock. This is all of it. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll be back after a quick break. Stay with us. The 56th Annual New York Film Festival will kick off on Friday, September 28th. It's an annual tradition for New Yorkers to head up to Lincoln Center to see some unique programming. This year, the festival's main slate includes films from 22 different countries, featuring many directors you know, Barry Jenkins, Jean-Luc Godard, the Coen brothers, and a few names you may not know, like the director of the festival's opening night selection, the favorite, Yorgos Lanthimos. For the next 2 weeks on All of It, we will feature conversations with some of the actors and directors featured at the New York Film Festival. Kent Jones is the director of the New York Film Festival, and he joins me in studio. Hi, Kent. Welcome to All of It.
How you doing?
I'm good. So can you give us a quick, brief history of the New York Film Festival?
The New York Film Festival was started in the early 60s, and originally it was Richard Rowe and Amos Vogel who began it. It started at Lincoln Center. At a certain point, it was just Richard Rowd. He invited people to be on a kind of a rotating selection committee. And from the start, the whole mission of the New York Film Festival was programming, curating. No prizes, no marketplace, no nothing, but here are the best movies that we've seen. We're sharing them with you. I joined the Film Society of Lincoln Center in 1998. It was my predecessor at the New York Film Festival, Richard Pena, who invited me to come aboard. I became a member of the selection committee in 2002. At a certain point, I thought, hey, maybe it would be great to have some prizes. Richard was just like, no, never. And I have to say, I think he was 100% right, because in the landscape of festivals, that means that, you know, we stand for the art of cinema, period. If, you know, these are our selections. We're not saying, you know, you can't disagree with us. We just want you to come and see them, and then we'll talk about them.
So that's how it differs from something like Cannes or...
Yeah, Con is a lot of prizes.
Lots of prizes. Mm-hmm. When you're programming a festival like this, what is your approach? Is it films we like? Is it films about the zeitgeist? How do you decide your mix?
I think that when you get into guesses about what the zeitgeist is, what people are going to like, what the audience is going to think, then you veer away from the mission. I think that the zeitgeist is just there. You know, people ask me every year, what are the themes that you guys pursued, you know, with the festival? And, you know, my answer is always the same. You know, we didn't. The themes arise after the selection is made.
They emerge?
Well, inevitably, because, you know, it's a lot of movies made at the same mm-hmm. moment in history. And what a moment it is.
Absolutely. Do New Yorkers let you know what they want to see in the festival, and what kind of feedback have you gotten over the years?
Well, I mean, they don't let us know what they want to see because, again, we're the ones who are making the selections. After the fact,
yeah.
Do we hear from people about whether or not they liked it? Yeah, sure. You know,
it's New York, right?
Yeah. Oh, I hated that. You know, it was like, good. Glad you came. You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, that's basically, I'm always interested in, it's really boring when everybody agrees. I mean, really boring. You know, I got an email yesterday from a critic who had a very interesting objection to one of the films that we're showing. I won't talk about which one, but, you know, I didn't agree with him, but I was very interested in his point of view.
And there must be some sort of texture there. If there's no texture, that's when everybody agrees, when something's sort of flat and smooth.
Well, I mean, you know, total consensus is never possible, you know, and it shouldn't be. I mean, you know, that's the point in life, in government, and in selecting movies.
And in art.
Yep.
The favorite is the opening night selection. Why did you choose that?
Oh, that movie is a wild piece of entertainment. And it is also a very, very dark comedy. Pitch black. I mean, really. But really funny. And also... very lively, you know. It's a period piece, and it's based on, you know, the time of Queen Anne. It's just that it's, you know, it, there's a historical basis to it, but really, what it is it's this sexual power struggle, sexual political power struggle, and it's just a wild movie, and it's an amazing feat by Yorgos Lanthimos, the director, and the principal actresses. They're amazing.
Another main slate film is Happy as Lazaro, and I want to read what one review said about it. Mixes time-bending fabulism with contemporary social critique to gradually exhilarating effect.
That's a lot of words.
That is a lot of words.
No, I think that's, you know, that sounds just to me. I mean, it's by an Italian filmmaker named Alice Rohrwacher, a German name. Her father's German. She grew up in Fiesole in Tuscany. Her dad was a beekeeper. And her films are always very, very close to the ground, very close to the earth. And this one has this level of magic realism and social commentary that's very few people can pull that off, I think.
And Julian Schnabel has a new film out.
Mm-hmm.
What's
about
that?
Van Gogh.
Ah!
Yeah. It's called At Eternity's Gate. And it's something that Julian, I remember hearing about it from him like 2 years ago. He was talking about it. And, you know, I thought, oh, okay, another movie about Van Gogh. There have been a few of them. There's Lust for Life. There's Robert Altman's movie, Maurice Pialat's movie. They're all very good. This one is too. But it's a unique film about Van Gogh in that it is a film about Van Gogh, the painter, by a painter. And Willem Dafoe is absolutely incredible in the lead. Incredible.
Is it about Van Gogh's early life, or is it about his madness, or is it about his brother, Theo?
It's about the end of his life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about the last days. But unlike a lot of, it has every dimension. There's the spiritual dimension. There's the dimension of the painterly dimension, which I must say is not that present in a lot of the other movies. You have shots of people dabbing paint on canvases. This is really about his work as a painter, and then, of course, the madness as well, and that's the relationship with Theo.
And that's so interesting, as you mentioned, a painter making a film about a painter.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's it's perfect continuity with Julian's first film, Basquiat.
Yeah, oh, of course. Yeah. Where'd my brain go? Outside of the film screenings, what else can people enjoy?
We have a lot of great talks, a lot of terrific conversations, for instance, on cinema with Claire Denis, the director of High Life. There are, you know, many films that we're showing that are by regulars at the New York Film Festival, and they're regulars because they're great filmmakers. Claire Denis, Jajanka, who made Ashes Purest White, Olivier Assayas, who made Nonfiction, and Hong Sang-soo, a Korean filmmaker who made Hotel by the River and Grass. On Cinema is a thing that we do every year where we ask directors to choose scenes from films by other people that have inspired them. And so this year it's Claire. There are also directors' dialogues that we're doing. There are live talks that are done by my colleagues Eugene Hernandez and Brian Brooks, both of whom have birthdays coming up. So do I. It's birthday season around there. It's Libra heaven. We also have some special events. There's a silent film, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. That's the movie that made Rudolph Valentino a star with live orchestral accompaniment, live musical accompaniment, I should say, not a full orchestra. There's the return of Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind, not the return, actually the completion of The Other Side of the Wind. It's a legendary film that's been in the work that was left unmade at the time of Welles' death. And now it has been finished. And so we'll be showing that in conjunction with a documentary about the film called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. There'll be a panel discussion after The Other Side of the Wind with Peter Bogdanovich, who was very involved in the film, who's in the film. A lot of the film was shot in his house. And Bob Murkowski, the editor, Frank Marshall, the producer, Jan-Philipp Rimsa, the producer, and Martin Scorsese is going to join us.
That's a full slate.
Mm-hmm.
Kent Jones is the director of the New York Film Festival. Thanks for coming down and joining us today.
Thanks very much.
For the next 2 weeks on All of It, throughout the New York Film Festival, we will be visited by actors and directors whose projects are featured in this year's festival, so please join us for that. You can buy tickets to the New York Film Festival online at filmlink.org/NYFF, through the Film Society app, or at the Alice Tilley Hall box office. Curated by Lina Mata, contemporary Arab cinema runs at BAM through October 5th and features work from several countries, including Iraq, Tunisia, Egypt, Algeria, and Lebanon. The content of these films is wide-ranging, from love stories to religious celebrations to desperate acts of self-preservation, and most were made in just the past 2 years. Welcome to All of It, Lina.
Thank you very much. It's a bit surreal for me, but I'm very excited to be here.
When did you first conceive of this film festival?
You know, I'd been living in Dubai for a while, and the Gulf countries had started doing their international film festivals with a concentration on Arab films. So for the first time, I was seeing films that were of a quality that I thought would travel really well. Because before that, Arab films had gone through their ups and downs, and they were very local, the quality of production was not that good. And I was seeing films that were telling amazing stories that were not being seen beyond the festival circuit in the region. And we were all coming up from like the post 9/11. And I'd been before that living in the States for a very long time with people every time you told them that you were from Lebanon, they weren't quite sure where it was. You had to say that you were by Israel so that they could locate you. So it felt like there was this major disconnect between the West and the East. And here were these great artists who were telling wonderful stories about the region, but these stories were not being heard. So I'd been living in the Westchester area for a while when I lived in New York, and the Jacob Burns was down the street, and they had their own film series. So I had a friend who was there, and she approached the programmer of the Burns, Brian Ackerman, and asked him if they'd be interested in a film series about the Arab world, and he said he would be very interested, but he didn't have anybody in mind. So she pitched me, and I met with him, and that's kind of how it started. So like it was just... We tested out one film in 2011, kind of worked out really well. We had our first year in 2012. People loved it, and it's been growing since. And this year is our first year at BAM, so it's exciting to have it move from Westchester down to Brooklyn.
How did you connect with BAM for this?
Well, Gina, who used to be part of Brian's team at the Jacob Burns, is now running the Cinetech at BAM. And she is invited a couple of the series that they have at the Jacob Burns, and I'm one of the series that she invited.
It's interesting that when you first started the series, you realized, wow, film can really be a conduit between what the West thinks of the East. What kind of stories did you want to make sure that Western audiences were going to have exposure to?
You know, all sorts of stories. I mean, the most obvious one is the Palestinian-Israeli story. You get it from one perspective, but in this series, you're getting it from the other perspective. One doesn't negate the other, but they're two very different perspectives living under one reality. Lebanon's gone through a civil war. Syria's going through a civil war. Egypt, Tunisia, Libya have had their Arab Spring. So all these stories, and then you have the traditions, you have stories of, you know, honor killings or child brides. All these stories were not being told from the perspective of the people who were living them or whose traditions these were, so that they could explain them to you in a way that was contextualized. So these were the kind of stories that
How many countries are represented this year?
This year we have from Lebanon, from Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, Iraq, Kurdistan, and Palestine.
And how did you just choose which films to pick? Were there themes you wanted to express this year?
You know, there's not that many films that come out on an annual basis for me to say I want to do a theme this year. So what I do is I read out, I mean, I follow all the filmmakers that we've had in the past. I read about all the new films that are coming out. Initially, it was easier up until this year. There were three film festivals in the Gulf that concentrated on Arab films. So if I just attended all of these, I have 90% of my selection. Mm-hmm. But they've all slowly died down, with the last one dying down earlier this year. So now it's about, you know, keeping an eye on what's coming out of Berlin, what's coming out of Toronto, what's coming out of Sundance, and all the other big film festivals that carry Cannes. Mm-hmm. And then just following the filmmakers and whatever news is coming out from them or from their representatives, and just ask for links and sit there and watch those links.
Let me ask you about a few films that I'm interested in. Beauty and the Dogs. It takes a look at a difficult theme. A young woman is raped by police officers. Tell us a little bit about its director.
She's approached the film in a very interesting way. The film is based on a true story that had happened in 2012, and then there was a book that was made about the story, and she based her film on the book. And what she's done is she's directed it in a way that's very unique. She's divided it into 9 chapters, and each chapter is a single take. So they spent months, like 3 months, I think, rehearsing so that she could get her crew and her actors to follow in, you know, to be able to do the tracking. So that she could get, and the reason that she did it in these chapters is that she felt that it increased the intensity. So
doing something in a single take is incredibly hard.
Yep, it's incredibly hard. I mean, yes, one could argue that it may not have served the film necessarily, but because, let's not go into that. I think it's very interesting that she did it that way.
One of the reviews in the trailer for it, one of the reviews says, "Forget Wonder Woman, I found my hero." That this young woman, ultimately, I don't want to give too much away, she is a heroine in it. Was that important to you, to have films that depicted young Arab women as heroines?
I think it's very important to show Arab women that having a voice and being strong. I think we're always seen as, the covered woman that's being abused by, you know, the men. And we have very tough Arab women. And this specific character, her story arc is, she really transitions from being a victim to being somebody who is going to stand up to the system and say, "To hell with you all, you've treated me like crap, and I am going to show you." Mm-hmm. So it's so relevant to what we're going through this whole year with the whole Me Too movement, and to know that it's happening not just in the West, but it's also happening in the Arab world is, I think, a very important message to put across.
Another film I want to ask about is called The Journey. Al Jazeera called it the first Iraqi film to be shown in theaters of Iraq in 25 years. Is that true?
It is true. We had the director come in and talk about the film. And yes, I think Iraqi cinema, Iraq has been going through one conflict after the next. And Mohammad Daraji, the director of this film, has been based in Europe. And he has gone back to Iraq since 2013, and he's created some kind of like film community. And he's training filmmakers, he's training actors, and he's working with all of these people to get his film. So none of the actors in the film, except for one, are professionals. And for instance, what he does is he tries to show you a cross-section. The film takes place in a train station, and it's about this woman who's coming in to blow herself up. And while she's there, we see all the people who are in and out of the train station. And so you have a bride that just ran away from, a runaway bride. You have a woman who wants to give up her baby. You have the American soldiers that are coming in to protect because it's the grand opening. And then you have a band of musicians that are playing. And for instance, so the band of musicians is the conductor of the National Orchestra in Iraq. So he just, this woman, he had worked with her, he said, for 2 years to train her to act. You know, he did like military training with her, because she has to look very stoic. She has to stand up straight, and she's carrying, the suicide belt around her. So there's a certain look that she has to portray throughout the whole film. So he claims to have worked with her for 2 years and given her this military training to be able to carry herself in the way that she has.
Those are two of the films that I found interesting. Would you like to share one that you're particularly excited about?
There's one called The Reports of Sarah and Salim, and it takes place, it's about an affair which would be, you know, something that happens everywhere. But this one happens to be between an Israeli woman and a Palestinian man, and they happen to be living in Jerusalem, which is a city that's divided. So Jerusalem becomes, you know, in addition to the two main characters and their respective spouses, Jerusalem becomes another character in the film, because no affair will have the consequences that an affair in Jerusalem will have. So I think that's one definitely worth taking a look at.
The festival runs from September 29th through October 4th at BAM. Lina Mata, who curated the Contemporary Arab Cinema Festival, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.